Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
December the 5th. Okay, and it is also the fifth night of Hanukkah, coincidentally. And we are closing in at the end of Parshas Vayechi in our creation series. We are on page 286, and right, verse 10. And mark your calendars, 2 weeks from tonight, Mitzvah Hashem, we will have our Siyum on Sefer Bereishis, the entire book of Bereishis. And as of now, it will be at our home, and it will be at 8 p.m. We'll see if we change it all over the next week or so. But that is what where it stands right now. On the 19th, 2 weeks from tonight, on the 19th of December.
When I was doing some study or something, I realized we're going to finish the same time.
That's right. That's right. The day before on Shabbos, they're going to finish Parshas Vayechi. There's going to be a Chazak, and we'll have our own Chazak. That's right. That's right. Okay. So Pasuk Yud, verse 10. So the brothers have carried Yaakov up to Eretz Yisrael, and now they are getting ready to bury him. They're not quite there yet, but they're en route, and they're up. They've come from Egypt all the way up to Israel, and now we continue. Vayavo ad Goren ha'atad, and they came to Goren ha'atad. Now they translate it as
Goren ha'atad.
Okay. A tud is a thorn. Goren is, it could be a granary or it could be an orchard. It means it's not just a field, it's a field of food, let's say grain, and it is also of thorns. So the way that the commentaries explain the Mefarshim say, it was a goren, a granary, but it was surrounded by thorns all around it, on its perimeter. Asher be'ever hayarden, that is on the other side of the Jordan. Vayispedu sham misped gadol v'chaved ma'od, and they eulogize there a great and heavy eulogy, a very great and heavy eulogy. Vayas li'aviv evel shivas yamim, and he made for his father, he means Yosef, made for his father a mourning of 7 days. So it seems that now they sat Shiva, or they had not sat Shiva before, even though they had cried for Yaakov already for 70 days in Egypt. Here they now sit Shiva for 7 days.
Why did they go up to the other side?
Okay, hold on. We have to. Vayar Yosef Haaretz Esa'evel. And those who dwelled in the land of Canaan saw the mourning. Begoren ha'atad, in this granary of thorns. Vayomru, and they said, Evel kaved zel lemitzrayim. This is a heavy mourning for Egypt. Al kain kara shema avel mitzrayim. Therefore, he called its name the morning of Mitzrayim, Avel Mitzrayim, Asher be'ever hayardain, that is on the other side of the Jordan. Vayasu vanav lo ken kasher tzivam, and his sons did for him, meaning Yaakov's sons did for him, as he commanded. Vayisu oso vanav arzo kenan, his sons carried him to the land of Canaan. Vayikberu oso, and they buried him, bimaras sedeha machpelah, in the cave of the double field of the field of Machpelah, Asher kana Avraham es hasadel achuz as kever. Then Avraham purchased the field as a burial plot, meis Ephron achiti, from Ephron the Chiti, al pnei Mamre, on the face of Mamre. Now there are several curiosities here. The first one Linda already mentioned, which is why is this place on the other side of the Jordan River? If you're coming up from Egypt to Israel, there's no need to cross the Jordan. I'll show you that in a moment. And So that's one issue. Why is this on the other side of the Jordan River? And it says it twice. It points out where it is two times. First, in Pasuk Yud, verse 10, it says, Asher Be'eva HaYarden, that's on the other side of the Jordan. And then again, at the end of Pasuk Yod Aleph, at the end of 11, it says, Asher Be'eva HaYarden, that is on the other side of the Jordan. What is this granary surrounded by thorns? What's important about that? And what does it mean that they said, the nations said, this, the people who lived in Canaan said, this is a great mourning for Egypt. Mm-hmm. It's a great mourning for the Jewish people too. What is the great mourning for Egypt? So, there are a few different explanations here. There is a nice map of Israel in here somewhere. If someone can locate it before I do, that would be helpful. I think it's in Parshas Pinchas, actually. What's that?
876 is
Pinchas. Yeah, but where's that map? If not, I will draw you a crude map. Well, there's one on page 923. That one does not include the that one does not include Egypt, but at least it has Israel. When you are traveling from, you have your map of Israel there in front of you. So that at least gives us some frame of reference. You see the Jordan River runs from Sukkot, runs from the Yam Kinneret, from the Kinneret Sea, down to the Dead Sea. Now, if you are traveling from Egypt to Israel, Egypt is Sukkot is southwest of Israel. Now, let's put this on the board so at least we have some frame of reference. This way, when I draw my picture of Israel, none of you have a problem with it because you see it in front of you. So you'll just pretend that my picture is exactly what you see on that. Okay. If you're traveling from Egypt to Israel, Israel, well, the state of Israel today goes further south in the picture. But we're going to deal with the biblical country of Israel, runs something along these lines. Okay, we won't, the north doesn't really trouble us right now. The Jordan and the Dead Sea, approximately here is the Jordan River. This is where Israel would be. Egypt is down over here, with the Nile River snaking down in that direction. Going, it runs from south to north, up to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, when coming from Egypt to Israel, there are three routes that the Torah discusses. The Torah discusses the routes from Egypt to Israel extensively, where?
At the Exodus,
when the Jews leave Egypt. In Parashas Bishalach, the Torah says that Hashem did not take the Jews along the route of the land of the Plishtim of the Philistines. He did not take them that way. What route would that be? That would be hugging the coast. That would be a route that would take them from Egypt along the coast into Israel. The Plishtim actually resided here along the coast. That would be Philistine land. And this would be Derech Eretz Plishtim. That would be one way to go. From Egypt, hugging the coast, heading up into Israel. That's the most direct way to go to Israel from Egypt. To travel by land, hugging the coast. That's the most direct way. Another way to go, which is the way they actually went, was further south. I don't know exactly where they were in Egypt, but they headed south. When you go south down here, you end up hitting an arm of the Red Sea. According to many opinions, that was the place that they crossed, the Red Sea. That would be the crossing of the sea. And they end up on the Sinai Peninsula, which is down here somewhere, and coming up to Israel from the south. So instead of from the southwest, coming up to Israel from directly from the south. And when the Jews came up to Israel, and they sent the spies into Israel, It was from here. This is from where they sent the spies. That area right there is where they sent the spies from the south of Israel into Israel. And had the spies come back with a positive report instead of a negative report, and had the Jews not sinned with the spies, they would have entered Israel directly from the south, which is the second most direct route coming from Egypt. The most direct route would have been hugging the coast. For whatever reason, Hashem did not take them that way. We'll discuss that in Mirtz Hashem when we get to it. Please God, when we get to it, in Parashas Bishalach. But instead, he took them along the south, and they should have entered Israel from the south. But the Jews sinned. And because they sinned, they couldn't enter from the south anymore. They had to wander the desert for another 38 years, total of 40 years. And then they were ready to go into Israel. But when they were ready to go into Israel this time, Hashem didn't take them from the south. Hashem had them go from the desert all the way around and enter from the east. That was the way he had them go. Down here are the lands of Edom and Moab, etc. Other countries reside around the southern, southeast, and eastern borders of Israel. And they ended up coming to Israel from the east. That's obviously a very indirect route from Egypt. Coming from Egypt to go all the way this way, all the way to the east, all the way up north, and then coming back around from the east side going west is obviously very circuitous to enter Israel in that direction. Those are the three routes the Torah discusses. And the Torah discusses how the Jews, Hashem didn't take them this way. He did take them this way. So he didn't take them along the A route. He took them along the B route. Mm-hmm. They sinned and ended up going in through the C route.
Mm-hmm.
C as in the letter C. That's what actually happened. When the brothers took Yaakov to bury him in Israel, you would have expected that they would have taken either the A route or the B route minus the splitting of the sea. But they would have entered either by hugging the coast, which is the most direct route, or they would have entered directly from the south. Now the terrain gets in the way over here. You look on a flat map, you say, well, you can head in, you can go in any of these areas, you can go in. But it's not so simple, because there's terrain, there's other countries. There's only a few different paths that actually work. So you would have expected that they would have entered Israel either this route or this route. The Torah doesn't tell us what route they took. However, we have a hint to what route they took, because we know that for some reason they were on the other side of the Jordan. This is the other side of the Jordan. That's Eiver HaYarden. Eiver HaYarden is the other side. Eiver HaYarden. The other side of the Jordan. What do you mean the other side? The other side from what? The other side from the land of Israel. This is the land of Israel. The other side is on what is known as the east bank of the Jordan River. The west bank of the Jordan River is Israel proper. The east bank, which is now the country of Jordan, is Eiver HaYarden. In fact, what was the name of the country Jordan before modern, well, until recently?
Transjordan.
Transjordan. What does trans mean?
Cross.
Cross. It was called across the Jordan, the other side of the Jordan. Eiver HaYarden is translated as Transjordan. That's what it is. This is Transjordan, Eiver HaYarden. That's a very accurate name for the country, Transjordan, because that's what we called it. It was called Eiver HaYarden, the other side of the Jordan. So, for some reason, Yosef and his brothers find themselves in Transjordan. They're in Eiver HaYarden. This Goren Ha'atad, this granary surrounded by thorns, is on the other side of the Jordan. Now that's very strange, because the Hebron, where the Ma'aras HaMachpelah is of course on the west side of the Jordan River, on the west bank. That's where it's a little bit south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is somewhere around here, so it's, you know, a little bit south is where the Ma'aras HaMachpelah is, where they were burying Yaakov. So it's very strange that somehow they end up on the other side of the Jordan River. To me, the only explanation I can think of is that the route they took was this very circuitous route.
to come into Israel. Because it's very strange that they would have come one of the more direct routes and then crossed the Jordan River and then came back. That's very strange. Why would they do that? It makes more sense to me that they took the circuitous route and came in from that side. Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they go the direct route? Now, it could be that there were impediments. Could be there were countries that wouldn't let them pass through. Could be the terrain wouldn't allow them to go through. Something along those lines. But what we could say, for whatever, we don't know what the practical reason is why they couldn't do it, but we do know there's a concept called Maisa Avos, Simin Labanim, which means what happens to our ancestors is symbolic of what would happen to their descendants. What happened to our ancestors, to the patriarchs and matriarchs, is symbolic of what would happen to us in later generations. This idea of Maisa Avo Simin Labanim finds expression throughout the Chumash, where we find history repeats itself. For instance, you know, of course, that Abraham, when he first came to Israel, there was a famine. And because of the famine, he was forced to go down to Egypt. And when he got to Egypt, his wife Sarah was taken. And then Hashem struck Paro with a plague. He had to let Sarah go. And Avraham and Sarah left Egypt with great wealth. That was symbolic of the future, that the Jews would have to go down to Egypt because of a famine. And the Egyptians would try to hold on to us. They were struck with plagues. And we left Egypt with great wealth. That's Maisa Avo Simin Labanim. What happened to Abraham and Sarah was symbolic of what would happen to their future generations. Here as well, it is possible, I am surmising, that what happened here, for whatever reason, which the Torah does not share with us why it happened, but for whatever reason, that the brothers took Yaakov along the circuitous route to Israel, that would then be symbolic of what would happen in the future, that the descendants also ended up not going the two more direct routes, but ended up going the more indirect route into Eretz Yisrael. Perhaps that is what is going on here. But be that as it may, Goren Ha'atad, this granary surrounded by thorns, is in Aver Hayarden. It's on the other side of the Jordan River. Yeah.
Do you think that Yosef and his brothers knew why they were crossing?
I don't know because I don't know how it happened. I don't know if it's because of my idea or if it's because they actually crossed the river. I have no idea, so I don't know if they knew or didn't know. Whatever it is, circumstances would have it that they ended up on the wrong side of the Jordan River.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Aver HaYarden, the other side of the Jordan. Now what about Goren HaAtad? Why? What is this granary surrounded by thorns? I'm going to tell you two explanations, both of which can be correct. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. They can both be acceptable. Both are found. One is found in a Medrash, and the other one, the Kliyakar, one of the Mefarshim, one of the commentaries, says. The Medrash says that there wasn't really a granary surrounded by thorns. That's not actually what there was. The people of Canaan, when they saw this great entourage from Egypt coming up to Israel,
mm-hmm.
and remember that Paro sent along with Yaakov's body, he sent chariots and soldiers. It was a very powerful entourage. When they saw this, the Canaanim came to wage war. The people of Canaan came with their weapons in order to wage war against the Egyptians. When they came and they saw the procession and they saw the coffin of Yaakov, and as a sign of mourning and of respect, Yosef had removed the crown from his head and hung it from the coffin of Yaakov. So they, Canaanim, when they came and they saw this spectacle, they realized what had happened, and they too, in respect for Yaakov, removed their crowns from their heads and also hung them around the coffin of Yaakov. And so Yaakov's coffin resembled a goren, a granary, that was now surrounded by thorns, because a crown has points at the top. And if you're hanging crowns all around the coffin, then there are now points jutting out in all directions. It is a coffin, a granary surrounded by thorns. Why a granary? Why would Yaakov's coffin be considered a granary? Because remember, there was to be a famine for at least 7 years. Mm-hmm. Yaakov came after 2 years and the famine stopped. So Yaakov is representative of Parnassa, of grain, of sustenance. And so his remains, his coffin surrounded by those crowns, is like a granary surrounded by thorns. That is what the Medrash says as one explanation for this Goren Ha'atad. So then there wouldn't actually be a granary, there wouldn't actually be thorns, but it was symbolic of that, and that's why it's called Goren Ha'atad. And there would have been a war between the Egyptians and the Canaanim, but because of deference for Yaakov, that was averted, and instead they paid their respects to Yaakov. Remember that our patriarchs and matriarchs were well-known individuals who commanded tremendous respect. When Sarah passed away, the Torah tells us that everybody came. They stopped their livelihoods and they all came to pay respects to Sarah. They understood the greatness of these individuals, and people from miles around came to pay the last respects. Here as well, when they saw what had happened, they paid their respects. That's one explanation. That's one explanation. A second explanation is that they actually did encounter a granary, a large field filled with grain, surrounded by a perimeter of thorns. That's a highly unusual thing. Normally, a field, it has some sort of fence around it or something like that, but there has to be a way in. There has to be a way for whoever's tending the field to get in, to get out, to be around. And here they encountered a granary, a place, a field full of wheat, full of grain, but completely enclosed by thorns. No way to get in to get at the wheat. This was to them symbolic of the fact that Yaakov, when he came to Egypt, he brought sustenance with him. The famine stopped. But now that Yaakov had passed away, the famine was going to return. And so the grain, that abundant grain that is growing, now becomes completely enclosed by thorns and it becomes inaccessible. Where before it was in abundance, mm-hmm. Now it gets closed off. And they understood that when they approached this area and they saw that it was completely surrounded by thorns, they realized that this was a simon, this was a symbol from God, that now the famine was going to return, that now sustenance would be closed off, that the thorns would prevent anybody from getting to the field. As a result, when they got to Goren Ha'atad, they held a mourning, because now they fully appreciated the loss of Yaakov. The Gemara relates a story that when the great sage Rav was one of the great sages of the Talmud, when the great sage Rav passed away, his students paid the last respects and buried him. Mm-hmm. And they held a eulogy for the great sage Rav. Mm-hmm. They were returning from having eulogized him, and when they had returned, they sat down to have a meal. When they sat down to have a meal together, they ate, and then they had a question. They had a question, an intricate question involving the laws of blessings in the blessings after a meal, benching that we do after a meal, there was an intricate question that they had. They had done something unusual, and they weren't sure now what is the proper halacha, what is the right thing to do under the circumstances. And each of the students talked to each other about it, and they realized they did not know the answer. And at that moment, they said, our teacher, Rav, has passed away, and we don't even know how to bench. We don't even know how to bless Hashem properly. And they made a second eulogy all over again. They mourned all over again. Why? Because it hit home what the loss really was. Mm-hmm. A person can pass away, and the purpose of a eulogy, what's the whole reason for a eulogy anyway? Why do we eulogize a person? So there's several reasons given, but one of the reasons given is to fully appreciate what it is we have lost. What did this person mean to those who have been left behind? What was the impact this person had on the world? What was this person's legacy? That helps us appreciate what it is that we have lost. That's the purpose of a eulogy. And the Gemara says that the best type of eulogy, the mitzvah of a eulogy, what is a eulogizer? What is his goal? What is his aim? What should a person be doing when they're standing up there eulogizing someone who's passed away? What is the goal? The Gemara says, igra de hespeda, the reward for delivering a eulogy is deluyi, is getting people to cry. That's the goal. Not to get people to laugh. The goal is to get people to cry. Because people don't laugh for missing something. They cry for missing something. And the goal of a eulogy is to get everybody to understand what it is that we have lost. That's the purpose of the eulogy. When there is a eulogy held and a mourning is held, and then later on the loss is appreciated from a different angle. There was something that we didn't realize that we had lost. We understood the person, the loss of the person in one regard or in one aspect, but then another aspect comes up and we didn't appreciate that. We never thought about that aspect of our loss. That's another reason to cry. That's another reason to eulogize. And that's why the students of Rav held another eulogy, another time of mourning, because now they understood the loss more profoundly. They understood it more deeply. The same thing happened over here. The Egyptians, the children of Yaakov, they had accompanied him, they had eulogized him for 70, cried for 70 days, and now on their way up to Israel, they encounter the field of grain totally enclosed by thorns, and they realized the famine is coming back. This is something we didn't appreciate before. We didn't understand what the loss really meant. And so they held another 7 days of mourning. And that's why the Kananim say this is a great mourning for Egypt. Why do they stress Egypt? Because Egypt is where the famine was going to come back to. Egypt was about to get hit with a major famine. And so this is underscoring that fact and emphasizing that fact that this is a mourning of for Egypt. Now Pasuk Yud Beis and Yud Gimel 12 and 13, his children did to him as he commanded, and they carried him to the land of Canaan, and they buried him in the Maras HaMachpelah. Rashi here brings the Gemara, he cites the Gemara, that what does it mean that the brothers did to him as he had commanded? Yaakov commanded the brothers to carry his coffin in a particular way. He was very specific about how he wanted the brothers to carry his coffin. He said, I want the 12 of you to be in four directions, three in each direction, three on each side of my coffin, and I want you to carry me as follows. I want Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun to be on the east. I want Reuven, Shimon, and Gad to be on the south. I want Ephraim, Menashe, and Binyamin to be on the west, because I don't want Yosef carrying my coffin, because he's really a king and he shouldn't lower himself. He shouldn't lower his position to carry a coffin. Instead, his sons, Ephraim and Menashe, should carry instead of him. and on the north of my coffin should be Dan, Naphtali, and Asher. He said, Levi should not carry my coffin because eventually I know through prophecy that he's going to carry the ark. He's going to carry the ark that holds the Ten Commandments, holds the tablets in it. And therefore, because he's from the Levim, are the ones that carry it. So he shouldn't carry up my coffin. So Levi shouldn't carry and Yosef shouldn't carry. In place of them should be Ephraim and Manasseh. And he told them how to carry three on the east, three on the south, three on the west, and three on the north. And the ones that he picked to go in each direction would eventually be the directions that the Jews would travel in the wilderness. In Parshas Bamidbar, when the Jews are divided up into separate camps, separate flags, separate banners that represent each tribe, the Jews are divided up in exactly the way that they carried Yaakov's coffin. In the Midbar, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is in the middle, surrounded by the Kohanim and the Levim. And then, to the east of the Mishkan goes Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun. To the south goes Reuven, Shimon, and Gad. To the west goes Ephraim, Menashe, and Binyamin. And to the north goes Dan, Naphtali, and Asher. Exactly in that way. Again, here we have an example of Maise Avos Simin Labanim, that what the patriarchs and matriarchs did was symbolic of what would happen in the future. And here it is inescapable the way that Yaakov, his coffin, is analogous to the Mishkan itself, the tabernacle itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yaakov here represents the Mishkan, the tabernacle. And the brothers surrounding Yaakov are symbolic of the future when their descendants will surround the tabernacle, surround the Mishkan in the wilderness. So they bury Yaakov. Pasuk Yudal, verse 14. Vayashav Yosef Mitzrayma hu ve'echav, and Yosef returned to Egypt, he and his brothers. V'chol ha'olim ito likbor es aviv, and all those who went up with him to bury his father. Acharei kavro es aviv, after he buried his father. I want to show you a contrast over here. If you notice, if you turn back one page, starting with the bottom of the page, Pasuk Zion, verse 7, it says, Vayal Yosef likbor es aviv. Yosef went up to bury his father. Vayalu ito kola vefaro zikne veso. And they went up with him, all the servants of father of Paro, the elders of his house. Vachol zikne eretz Mitzrayim, and all the elders of Egypt. Vachol beis Yosef, and all the house of Yosef. Ve'echav, and his brothers. Ubeis aviv, and the house of his father. The order is the servants of Paro, the elders of Paro's house, and the elders of Egypt. And then comes the house of Yosef, his brothers, and the house of his father. On the way, that's on the way up to bury his father. On the way back, in Pasuk Yudal, verse 14, it says, Yosef returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and everybody else who went with him. The Mefarshim, the commentaries point out that on the way there, the elders of Egypt felt that they were more important. They were put first before the brothers. They were considered to be more deserving more respect. But on the way back, the verse lists the brothers first and then everybody else. Once the elders saw the way that the brothers were treated, the way Yaakov was treated with such great respect by the Egyptian, by the Canaanim, then they realized the greatness of the children of Yaakov, and they put them first on the way back to Egypt. Pasuk Tesvav, Vayiru 15, Vayiru Ache Yosef Kimes Avihem, the brothers of Yosef feared, they were afraid now that their father had died. The translation in, let's see, they translated as perceived, which means they saw. Sometimes Vayiru came in and they were afraid, but I thought that that's how somebody translated here, but I don't see that now. So they perceived, the brothers of Yosef saw that their father had died. Vayomru, and they said, Lu yistemenu Yosef. Maybe Yosef will hate us. How do they translate it over here?
Nurse hatred.
Will nurse hatred towards us. Okay? V'hashev yashiv lanu, and he will return to us, es kol hara'ah, the evil asher gamalnu, so that we did to him. As long as Yaakov was alive, they weren't afraid of retribution. But now that Yaakov has passed away, they are concerned that Yosef will pay them back in kind. And so, Vayitzavu el Yosef lemor, the way they translated here is they instructed that Yosef be told. They sent a message to Yosef. Avicha tziva, your father commanded, lifnemo so lemor, before his death, saying, Ko somru li Yosef, so you should say to Yosef, Ona, sana pesha achecha v'chata sam. Oh, please, kindly forgive now the pesha achecha means the sin of your brothers. V'chata sam is another word for sin. They say the spiteful deed of your brothers and their sin. Ki ra'ag malucha, for they did evil to you. V'ata sana lefesha avdei elokei avicha. And now, forgive the evil deed of the servants of the God of your father. Vayevk Yosef b'dabrom elav, and Yosef cried when they spoke to him. Vayalchu gam echav, and his brothers also went. Vayiplu lefanav, and they fell before him. Vayomru, and they said, Hinenu lecha la'avadim, behold, we are to you as slaves. So they are afraid of Yosef's retribution, and they send this message to Yosef, and Yosef cries, and they throw themselves before him. They say, "We'll be your slaves."
Explanation from 15 to 21.
What's that?
He
gives the whole explanation. Yeah. Okay. Vayomer alehem Yosef. Yosef said to them, "Al tirau, don't be afraid. Ki asachas Elokim ani, am I in place of God?" Va'atem chashavtem alai ra'ah. You had evil intentions against me. Elokim chashavon l'tova. But God intended it for good. Leman aso kayom azeh. In order to do like this day, v'hachayos amrav, to help an entire nation live. You may have an intention to hurt me, but in the end, really, God had in mind that I should end up becoming the viceroy in order to spare all of our lives. V'ata al tiro, and now don't be afraid. Anochi achal kel eschem v'estapchem, I will feed you and your children. V'yinachem osam, and he consoled them. V'yidaber al libam, and he spoke on their hearts. He spoke nicely to them in order that they should not be afraid. Yeah.
After all these years, doesn't this show like a major lack of Muna? And they saw all the goodness that came out of the whole situation.
Good.
Right. So were they punished for this little lack of...
No, they weren't punished for this. So I don't lack of emuna. Emuna suggests a lack of belief in God. Here, they're afraid of Yosef. They don't know what Yosef's going to do to them.
But, you know, during the meeting at the palace, I'm your brother, I love you, what happened
okay.
to that?
But their father's no longer alive. So let's see. Okay, let's understand what's going on here. The reason why we read all the way till here is because what were they afraid of exactly? Are they afraid that Yosef is going to execute them? Are they afraid he's going to imprison them? Are they afraid he's going to exile them? What exactly are they afraid of?
Revenge.
Okay. Revenge from what? Doing what?
From sending him to Egypt.
Yeah, but what would he do to them as revenge? So you see from the end over here that what they were afraid of was that he would no longer feed them. As it says in Pasuk Chafala, verse 21, now don't be afraid. I will feed you. I will support you and your children. I will give you sustenance. I will sustain you. They were afraid that Yosef would withhold sustenance from the brothers.
Why that's what they were afraid of.
So why that in particular? So this goes back to the fact that the famine has now returned. You see, they weren't afraid that Yosef was going to take revenge against them in some sort of spiteful, proactive way. They weren't afraid that he was going to send soldiers against them, that he was going to somehow sabotage them, or somehow deliberately hurt them. But now they needed to count on him just to survive. That's different. See, it's one thing to say, okay, let bygones be bygones. Yes, I did. I hurt you. I did the wrong thing. Please forgive me. And you say to me, okay, I'll forgive you. Which means that you're not going to take revenge against me. But that now I should need you to support me, and you're going to save me and help me anyway. That's going a little bit further. That's going much further. Imagine where you have two people. We'll call them Reuven and Shimon. And Reuven does a terrible thing against Shimon. Reuven just, you know, deliberately hurts Shimon. Reuven causes Shimon a tremendous loss of money, stabs Shimon in the back, speaks evil about Shimon, gets people not to like him. Shimon is disgraced because of Reuven, and just generally mistreats Shimon. And then Reuven regrets it, and he goes to Shimon and says, "I'm sorry, forgive me. I feel bad about what I did. I regret it. I was mean. I was spiteful. And please forgive me." And Shimon says, "Yes, Reuven, I forgive you. I forgive you. I won't hold it against you." Okay, so Shimon is not going to take revenge. And then it's discovered that Reuven has a terrible disease, and Shimon is a respected doctor and is the one who can heal Reuven. And now Reuven comes and begging on his knees before Shimon and says, "Please take me and please heal me." That's a second step. And it's one thing not to take revenge. It's another thing to actively go and save Reuven's life. And that Shimon should do that after having been mistreated by Reuven. That's a whole other step. As long as Yaakov was alive, the brothers weren't afraid of retribution from Yosef, not just because Yaakov was alive, but also because they didn't need Yosef to support them. They just needed that Yosef wouldn't actively take revenge. They weren't afraid of that. Yosef's not going to actively take revenge. But when Yaakov dies, and the famine comes back, they no longer have Yaakov around to kind of mediate, and they now need Yosef. That's a very difficult situation to be in, to go and essentially grovel and say, "We now need you desperately." That's a very, very difficult thing to do. And that's what they're afraid of. And Yosef assures them, "Don't worry, I'll take care of you. I'll take care of your children. No one's going to starve. I'm going to take care of you. And you need not worry. Yes, you may have had evil intentions in mind, but Hashem had positive intentions in mind." Why does Yosef say that? Why does Yosef say that you had evil intentions, but Hashem had positive intentions? Why is that necessary? Why can't Yosef just say, "Don't worry, I'll take care of you. You had evil intentions, but it doesn't matter. I understand you. You regret it, and I'm going to take care of you." Well, why does Yosef emphasize that you had evil intentions, but Hashem had good intentions? Today, I heard from Rabbi Goldberger that he had read that if somebody does something spiteful or mean to me, so it's wrong. The person shouldn't have done it. The person's wrong. The person, you know, speaks Lashon Hara about me, says something not nice, says something from my past that's embarrassing or shameful, and tells people about it, and I'm embarrassed and I'm ashamed. So what is... obviously, I'm angry at this person. The person should have done something like that, maybe, you know, to make me feel like that and hurt me like that for no good reason. So what is my way of dealing with it? He did it already. It happened. So now what's my way of dealing with that? So I shouldn't get angry. Best thing is not to get angry. A person should try to temper their anger, not to get angry. And not be... try not to get so upset about it. But, I mean, the person did hurt me. The person did something wrong. In my mind, what the person did is much worse than in the minds of those who it didn't happen to. A third party has a more objective perspective and can see it a little bit more fairly. But for the person who got hurt, I'm going to magnify what that person did. So how do I have perspective? How can I look at what happened in a way where I don't ignore the fact that he hurt me? He did hurt me. I'm not going to pretend he didn't hurt me. But what can I do to look at it, but from a more objective standpoint? So in any case, what can I do to be more objective, to try to be, not to have such an intense feeling about it? So I heard from Rabbi Goldberger today that he had read, I don't want to say any names because I don't remember which of the sages he was quoting, but he had read that one method of dealing with it is to say like this: if I was hurt or shamed, then evidently I needed to have that happen. Evidently that was important that it happened to me. Whether it was important because it helps me correct a certain aspect of myself, whether it's important because I once shamed somebody else and this is a way of atoning for it, whatever it is that could be made, maybe it's a test to see how I handle difficult situations, but evidently it was important that I go through this very unfortunate and painful experience. Evidently. Now, the person who did it was still wrong. Whether it was important or not, that doesn't mean this person had to do it. The person was wrong and did a sin in hurting me. But this is what he said: I can't blame him for the fact that it happened, because evidently it was important that it happened. I can only blame him for the fact that he did it. But I should separate in my mind that it happened from the fact that he did it. Yes, he did it. He's wrong. It was sinful. It was mean. The person did a bad thing. And I'm upset at him for doing that. But the fact that it happened, it was going to happen one way or another. Whether it would be this person that did it, or whether my shame and embarrassment would come about because I slipped and fell, or something embarrassing happened in front of a bunch of people. Something was going to happen. And so, if I can somehow separate the two, the fact that it happened from the fact that he did it, that would make all the difference in the world. Yosef here is separating the two things, saying it was going to happen anyway. Hashem wanted me to be in Egypt so I could become viceroy. If you wouldn't have sold me, it was going to happen anyway. Does that mean you guys were off the hook? Does that mean you did no sin whatsoever? No, of course you did wrong. It was bad what you did. But I'm not angry at you about the fact that it happened, because it was going to happen one way or another. I had to be in Egypt. I am upset at you that you did it, that you chose to do it. That's not a nice thing. But I don't hold it against you that it happened. It was going to happen anyway. That's perhaps what Yosef is doing over here. We're over time already. I do have to mention, for clarity's sake, that the Medrash says that on Yosef's way back from Israel to Egypt, he stopped at the pit that he was originally thrown in by the brothers and looked into the pit in order to...
remind them what they did?
No, that's what they thought.
See if there are any snakes or scorpions.
In order to recite the blessing of Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, blessed are you God, Sha'asa li nes b'makom hazeh, that you did for me a miracle in this place. Because remember, he was saved from the snakes and the scorpions. So he wanted to recite the blessing. So he looked into the pit and recited the blessings. But of course, the brothers interpreted that as he was looking in the pit and thinking to myself, they did this to me. So they were afraid that who knew what would happen.
How do we know that the brothers were thinking that?
This is what the Medrash says.